I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It was a battle that many historians think determined the outcome of the American Civil War. It was fought in the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, in early July of 1863. And Vermont troops played a key role in the Union victory in what became the bloodiest fighting in the entire war. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to listen back to an interview we first aired in 2017 with Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin, who shared his insight and some of his own research about the role Vermonters played at the Battle of Gettysburg and other important Civil War battles. Coffin is the author of several books on Vermonters in the Civil War, including Something Abides, Discovering the Civil War in Today's Vermont, Full Duty, Vermonters in the Civil War, 9 Months to Gettysburg, and The Battered Stars. I started the conversation by asking him about one of the first battles in the Civil War, the Battle of Bull Run. That fight was just outside of Washington, D.C., and historians have documented stories of the public going out in carriages with picnic lunches to watch the fight. Then the tide of the battle turned, and the spectators had to flee for their lives. I asked Coffin why so many people had such a naive view of the war.
Well, they came from Washington. They had seen the big Union Army in encampment around Washington. They knew that they were unbeatable, and so it was a beautiful day. Let's go out. And from a distance, near Bull Run, let's watch the battle. Let's watch the Union win the Civil War. But, of course, it turned into a disaster. They all headed back to Washington and interfered terribly with the retreat of the Union Army, leading to some captivities that never should have happened. But that just spread panic through the North. And one of the people who responded was a genius of a man from Western New York State named Hiram Berdan, who was an inventor and had made a tremendous amount of money. He invented a machine to separate gold from ore that's still in use today, and the folding lifeboat. Made all kinds of money, went to Washington, sold Lincoln and the Secretary of War on creating units of Northern sharpshooters. And it was a heck of an idea. And Berdan's idea was that these sharpshooters would hang out maybe a quarter mile behind the front lines and pick off Confederate officers from long distance. And he even designed special uniforms for these men. Blue uniforms with blue hats with feathers in them and fringes. But then he decided not blue, green for camouflage. Important move, you see. Good move. And then a gray coat for winter so they'd blend in with the snow and when the leaves are gone. Trouble with that is that how could you tell them from the Confederates? So he changes that uniform to another shade of green, and he begins to recruit throughout the North.
And at the beginning of the war, did people in Vermont think, it's going to be over in a couple of weeks?
Oh, sure. Lincoln asked for 75,000 troops. Vermont sends 750. The legislature backs that immediately, and the thought is that that'll do. That'll take care of things. But again, after Bull Run, more money has to be appropriated. More regiments are quickly raised. The panic is on.
So you talked about the creation of the sharpshooters. Was that a tough group to be part of? Were there qualifications for that?
Well, there were trials held throughout the North. The qualification was you had to bring your own rifle. You came to a trial. They set up a 10-inch bullseye on a target, 200 yards distant, and you had to put 10 straight shots into that bullseye. From 200 yards with an old rifle, that's not easy.
That sounds hard.
It's very hard. And Vermonters just flocked to these trials. They had a trial at the Rutland Fairgrounds in Bellows Falls, in Bennington, in Bethel, probably one in Woodstock throughout the state. Berdan apparently came to some of them. And the Vermonters proved to be remarkable remarkable shots.
Why was that true?
Well, I don't know. I've got some theories on it. I think the fact that Vermont is the inland New England state, we're isolated here. Hunting was the thing to do. There was a Bethel boy named Charles Fairbanks, who signs up younger than he should have, but his father signs a special paper, who made the qualification at the trial in Bethel. He said, I was born with a rifle in my hands. You know, I mean, apparently young men in Vermont just grew up shooting, and they were good. And when the first trial is held, they're trying to fill a company of 75 men. They get 125 qualifiers, and they send 100 south in F Company of the 1st USS Sharpshooters, United States Sharpshooters. So off they go to Hoboken, New Jersey, to join the rest of Berdan's regiment.
How do they become such an important military asset?
Well, they were a danger. Good shots are, a great asset to an army. Plans didn't work out the way Berdan had hoped. You know, he was going to have them behind the lines, shooting behind the Confederate lines. But, of course, a battle smoke gets tough. And so they mainly ended up out in front of the armies as skirmishers and picking off Confederates from an advanced position, not from the rear. But it was effective, and in several battles, they play incredibly important roles.
And we definitely want to talk about that. There's a connection here with President Lincoln, isn't there?
Absolutely. When they get to Hoboken, New Jersey first, they go into camp there for 10 days, and Berdan gives a shooting demonstration. He's probably the best shot in America. And not only does he hit all his targets at 200 yards, he does the same thing at 300 yards. And then at 600 yards, he puts a man-sized target up, calls it Jefferson Davis, and asks the spectators where he wants him to hit Jeff. Eye, he'll shoot him in the eye. Mouth, hit him in the mouth. Forehead. I mean, it was just an astonishing display. And then the sharpshooters, the 1st Regiment, goes down to Washington, goes into camp just north of the city, and they're practicing, and one day McClellan and Lincoln come by. And Berdan puts on another similar display. Lincoln asks the Vermonter, Cassius Peck from Brookfield, can I borrow your rifle? Of course. Peck hands it to him, and I don't know the exact outcome of Lincoln's shooting, but the Vermonter said that he shot well. Lincoln was all fired up about this sharpshooter arm. Eventually, there will be 3 sharpshooter regiments formed, and Vermont will send 3 sharpshooter companies to the Union armies on a per capita basis that is far, far more than any other Union state. Vermonters could shoot.
Let's turn to Emily in Milton. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've recently moved to Milton and bought a home. It was built in 1850, and I was told from the owner that the house was part of the Underground Railroad. It's got kind of a hidden basement that, you know, could plausibly have been a hiding place. And I was told by someone from the Historical Society of Milton that that was a myth, and that anyone who would have made it as far as Vermont would have gone on and crossed the border into Canada. And I was just wondering if we could get an expert to weigh in on that and
Well, I can tell you that you're along one of the major routes of the Underground Railroad through Vermont, which is Route 7. I can tell you that I don't agree with a lot of Underground Railroad experts that fugitive slaves did not hide when they got near the border. After all, they'd probably come 500 miles to get this close to freedom. Why take a chance with being out in the open? I think they did find places to hide. So it's possible that you do have an Underground Railroad place there. I would check perhaps with Rokeby in Ferrisburg, Jane Williamson, who's a great expert on that subject and a friend of mine.
Emily, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Duncan in Johnson. Hey, Duncan, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. Great to hear you, Howard, in another show on the Civil War. I just wanted to comment. My third great-grandfather, Amos Hastings, was a member of Company G, 2nd Regiment of the New Hampshire Sharpshooters. I believe they linked up with Vermont regiments at some point. He was wounded severely at the Battle of Antietam, but survived the war.
Yes, the Sharpshooters had a hard day at Antietam, fighting in that famous cornfield with Hooker's troops, perhaps the bloodiest battlefield of the Civil War. Farmer Miller's cornfield, 7,000 casualties in that 30-acre field.
So we had different states setting up their own sharpshooters?
Oh, yes. All the northern states were represented in the sharpshooter regiments. Again, three regiments. The first formed in Vermont is at Randolph, and William Y.Y. Ripley from Rutland commands it. He later will generally command the sharpshooters in battle because Burdan proved to be a coward. Burdan had no military experience, and when the shooting started, he always went to the rear. Got himself in some trouble for that. And then there was two more companies of the 2nd Regiment formed in Vermont, another at Randolph, commanded by Homer Stoughton, who will win fame at Gettysburg, and a third company of the 2nd Sharpshooter Regiment is formed down at Brattleboro. So three Vermont companies are off to war.
Duncan, do you have any letters from your great-great-great-grandfather?
I don't have letters, but we do have discharge records and requests for pension. As I said, he was severely wounded at the battlefield that Howard is referring to at Antietam. He tried for years to get a pension, unsuccessfully until about the third year of the last year of his life. When he finally got a small pension, and then they revoked it when he died.
Well, I have some sympathy with him. I lost a lot of my hearing in the 2nd Armored Division from tank and artillery fire, and I can't get hearing aids out of the VA, so the fight goes on.
Duncan, thank you very much for your phone call. Let's talk to Gail in Elizabethtown. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a great-grandfather who was in the 7th Vermont Volunteers, and I think he got a medal, but I don't know how to identify it. There's a little strip of gold in it with some numbers, and also I wondered if he learned to train horses in the Civil War, because he was very good at training horses. He could make them back up with a wagon the length of the street. And I wondered if he was training horses to carry the cannon.
He could have well have been a teamster. If he's in the 2nd Vermont, he serves in Louisiana, a bit in Mississippi. And then the regiment gets in trouble with General Butler, and he sends them down to Fort Barrancas, Florida, where they spend most of the war really not doing much until the end of the war when they fight at Mobile Bay. There weren't many medals given to the 7th Vermont. That medal, it could be a medal. More likely, it is a Grand Army of the Republic medal that he probably was given attending an encampment after the war. They're nice things to have. I have a collection.
Gail, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Church, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Church, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. My great-granduncle was E.W. Hines, captain of the F Company Sharpshooters. And we have remarkably little family oral history about him. I've done some searching, as has my son, Jeffrey, and we know he was discharged with a surgeon's certificate for disability after Gettysburg. But we can't find that. And my question is there a place where we might locate these surgeon certificates that enable the soldiers to be discharged on disability?
Yeah, the best place to go is, of course, the National Archives. and ask for his pension records. It'll cost you $90, but you'll get everything. Also, a possibility there might be something at Middlesex in the state military records in the state building out there. If he was with F Company, he was at Gettysburg, on the second day of the battle, he was out along the Emmitsburg Road, and he and his men went into the woods along the Emmitsburg Road and discovered the presence of Confederates, which tipped off the Union side that a big attack was coming at the southern end of their line. And, of course, that was the Longstreet attack that caused all the fighting at Round Top, Devil's Den, and so forth. So those F Company boys played a very important role at Gettysburg. There were many casualties, and quite a few of those men were captured.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today on the program, we're listening back to a conversation that first aired in 2017 with Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. In just a moment, we'll hear from Bill Cagle of the Milton Historical Society about efforts to preserve the home once owned by Vermont General George Stannard. But first, we'll return to the discussion with Coffin and dig into the three-day Battle of Gettysburg. Coffin says it was on the third day of the battle that Vermont troops, under General George Stannard, distinguished themselves and ultimately played a pivotal role in its outcome. But Coffin says research of his own now points to the second day of the three-day battle, one that involved Vermont's well-known sharpshooters, as one that merits more attention.
Well, of course, Vermonters are famous now worldwide for what they did on the third and final day at Gettysburg. On that day comes the most famous attack of the Civil War, Pickett's Charge, directed right at the Union center. Lee sends about 12,000 soldiers across the mile-wide valley, and they come close to breaking through the Union line. But suddenly, there's an attack launched from the south by 900 Vermont soldiers untested in battle, and they fire maybe 10,000 rounds into those massed Confederates, and it destroyed Pickett's Charge. And after the battle, it was the Confederates said it was the fire from the right, those Vermonters, that defeated us. So the case can easily be made that that third day, Vermont wins the Battle of Gettysburg, the Vermonters under George Garrison Stannard. But now there is a whole new aspect to this battle that's come my way on the second day. Now, Stannard's boys had done well on the second day in their first fighting. Late in the day, they helped to hold the Union line in the northern part of the battlefield. But another factor now comes in, the sharpshooters. I already told you that on the second day, Longstreet launches an attack against the southern end of the Union line about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that attack is detected forming up by Company F of the 1st U.S. Sharpshooters. But the 2nd U.S. Sharpshooters are also at Gettysburg under Homer Stoughton from Randolph. And they have been placed on the south end of the battlefield to watch for this likely Confederate advance. Now, we all know that the great heroes of day two at Gettysburg are the 20th Maine up on Little Round Top, Killer Angels, the movie Gettysburg's all about them, getting to Little Round Top just in time and holding off the assault of the 15th Alabama and then making a bayonet charge to save the day and hold Little Round Top and save the Union line. But what I have now discovered with the help of a good friend in Woodstock, Daryl Thompson, actually lives in Norwich now, just donated his great-grandfather's sharpshooter rifle to the Bridgewater Historical Society. He has shown me a letter from the leader of the Alabamians named Oates, Colonel Oates, written to Homer Stoughton 20 years after the war, in which he says, in essence, we would have had Round Top, but for you sharpshooters. The sharpshooters are out there in front of this massive Confederate assault coming from the south. They line themselves up in a farm lane behind a stone wall, and they begin to pick off the advancing Confederate thousands. And they inflict so many casualties that the Confederates stop their attack and reform and come on, and they're slowed again. And finally, the sharpshooters, to save their lives, are driven out of this road, but retreat firing across the fields, then up Big Round Top Hill, pursued by the Confederates, making the Confederates chase them all the way up over that hill. And so the Confederates have to take a roundabout route, being slowed anyway. So by the time they get to attack Round Top, and I have letters from a Vermont sharpshooters saying, as we look back, we could see troops coming on to Round Top. The delay by these Vermont-led troops and many Vermonters within the ranks, apparently, according to Oates, was the key factor in saving Round Top. Now, of course, the 20th Maine still had to do its fighting, but without the sharpshooters here, they would not have had the chance to defend Round Top because Oates would have been there first. It's a major, major change in the way we view the history of Vermont at Gettysburg, and another huge feather in the state's cap at Gettysburg, the most, by far the most important battle of the Civil War.
Right now, we're going to get an update about an important Civil War-related project taking place in Milton. It's an effort to restore the home of General George Stannard, and with us to talk about this effort is the co-chair of the project's committee, Bill Cagle. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Bill, some of our listeners might not be all that familiar with the career of George Stannard. Tell us something about him.
Well, Stannard was born in Georgia, Vermont in 1820. He was a citizen soldier who rose through the ranks, as Howard can tell you better than I, quite well due to his steely ability to command, and his overall patriotism. And he was just a very, very strong soldier, and he was a great leader and highly regarded, and arguably the most significant significant Civil War soldier from Vermont.
He makes the claim, Bill, that he was the first Vermonter to enlist, and I think he might be right.
And the longest serving, too, Howard?
Well, he also said that, and he rises fast. He commands the 9th Vermont, and then he gets command of the 2nd Vermont Brigade and leads them to Gettysburg, where the rest is history. Isn't he wonderful?
Absolutely. So we're looking to save his the house he owned in Milton, Vermont, right on the Milton-Colchester border. He owned this house after the Civil War, and it's a site it's the last remaining site that's closely tied to Stannard and available to tell his story, which we feel is extremely important.
And Bill, what's the condition of the home today?
It is it's in rough shape, but it is structurally sound. For the most part, we had it evaluated, did a full condition assessment done in 2014, and it is definitely savable. We need to do a lot of gutting of the interior, but the shell, the foundation, the framing is in good shape, and just ready for us when at the right time to go in with a full scale. Restoration.
Bob, there is just no monument to Stannard in this state. There really isn't. I mean, there's a monument at his grave in Burlington, but there needs to be a museum. There needs to be more. This is one of the truly great heroes of the Civil War, and these wonderful people in Milton, I'm working closely with them, have a huge job up there. They're going to need a lot of resources, so help him out. Stannard needs to be honored. And eventually, Bill, the hope is that we can have a Civil War heritage trail going most of the length of Route 7, and maybe this building can be the headquarters for all of it.
That would be a wonderful hope and an ideal outcome. We have begun our committee with the with the initiative of Howard, and from his great help, his book Something Abides, we have undertaken the developing a Vermont in the Civil War Heritage Trail, and we have had three meetings this year at different sites along the Route 7 corridor, which is the main focus, at least in the beginning of this trail. We've had meetings in at Rokeby in January, and then at the Bennington Museum in March, and then just earlier this month at Rutland. So these are all sites on the trail with Civil War significance. We've got a full list of sites to go all along the Route 7 corridor, all the way from Bennington to Swanton to the Canadian border, where the Raiders, the St. Albans Raiders escaped way back in 1864.
There's a ton of Civil War history along Route 7, and one of the wonderful sites is the Rutland Fairgrounds, where the sharpshooters held one of their sharpshooter trials, and that's very well documented. This is wonderful work, Bill. Keep it up, and also thank you to Senator Mazza and Senate institutions who got us some good money.
Amen to that. Definitely. Thank you, and thank you, Howard, for helping to testifying multiple times and working with that committee and us to we were able to secure some funding. $30,000 is coming to the General Standard House Restoration Fund after the new fiscal year starts from the state. The Institutions Committee is reallocating some funding that was originally earmarked for a monument project in Virginia that Howard was working on, and that project fell through. And the money's been sitting there for quite a while, and Howard.
We're bringing it home for a good project being done by good people. Thank you, Bill.
Bill Cagle, co-chair of the General Standard House Committee, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Eric, who is actually calling from Standard. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Well, welcome. Thank you. Can you hear me?
We sure
yes.
can.
Okay. Yeah, I was listening to a church asking about the references to find out about his relative's discharge, medical, whatnot. I have a book here that's called Revised Roster of the Vermont Volunteers and the War of the Rebellion.
Yes.
It was put out by the Adjutant General's Office in Montpelier in 1892.
It is our great reference on Vermonters in the Civil War.
It is about a 15-pounder, 806
right.
pages, and there are thousands of names in here. They tell when they were, where they came from, what the residence, their rank, date of enlistment, date of mustered, and then have remarks, and the remarks also include that they either died or they were mustered out. There is reference to that a General Standard was wounded four times and lost one of his arms.
That's right. And for all of all his great deeds, they named a town for him after the Civil War. They turned a gore into a town, named it Standard, and Standard, I guess, was grateful, but he never went there. Anybody who's interested in Vermont and the Civil War, you got to get a copy of that book he's talking about called Peck's Roster. That lists every one of the about 35,000 Vermonters that served with all the basic facts. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. We appreciate your phone call. We got this email from Robert, who said, a few years ago on Vermont Edition, you mentioned that you were interested in knowing how many of your ancestors served in the Civil War. I, too, have had that curiosity. And thanks to Ancestry.com and Fold3.com and other online sources, I've been able to identify nearly 500 ancestors from my great-grandfathers to fifth cousins who fought for the Union and the Confederacy. As you know so well, this research is a time-consuming process, but for me, it has been and continues to be well worth the time and effort. Are you familiar with Fold3.com?
No, I am not, and I may have to look that way because I've always been so proud of the six ancestors I can identify. Now I feel a bit overwhelmed. You've got most of a regiment there.
Let's turn to LJ in South Burlington. Hi, LJ. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call. My family and I visited Gettysburg in April, and there are two monuments that I wanted to mention. One is to the 1st Vermont Brigade, and the inscription on that one said that they had to endure a 32-mile forced march without stopping for food or water to arrive at Gettysburg. And the second monument was to the 13th Vermont Infantry. And the really powerful part of this monument was the very last sentence, where it said that it was erected by 193 of the survivors in 1899. And my family and I found it very powerful just to know how the Vermonters served. Thank you.
Yes. The monuments at Gettysburg are very well done to the Vermonters. The big monument with Stannard on top was the first big state monument built there. And then, of course, the 13th Vermont leads the attack on Pickett's Charge. They play a remarkable role. Also at Gettysburg, if you know where to look, are monuments to the sharpshooters out along the Emmitsburg Road, where they discovered the Confederates, and then along that farm lane where they made their stand against the Confederates who would eventually attack Round Top. I'm on my way to Gettysburg very soon to do some more research on the sharpshooters down there. I want to understand this perfectly, but I am soon going to be offering talks on the sharpshooters through the Humanities Council. This is such an important news story about Vermont and the Civil War. I want to get it out there.
And as LJ mentioned, I've been to Gettysburg a number of times, and it is really remarkable to stand behind the big boulders on Little Round Top and look down and think of people charging up the hill or going to where Pickett's Charge took place and looking at that field and thinking, this actually happened in this spot.
They actually came across this field. I remember a story from the great Civil War historian Edwin Barsh, having once been at Gettysburg with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and looking across the mile-wide field Pickett's Charge crossed. And the chairman turned to Edward Barsh and said, "I couldn't get the 102nd Airborne today to go across that field. Times have changed."
That's Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin speaking with Vermont Edition back in 2017. And before that, we heard from Bill Cagle of the Milton Historical Society. Since this discussion first aired in 2017, Cagle says the General Stannard House Committee completely disassembled General Stannard's house and this spring put the building into storage at the town of Milton's historic Bombardier Barn. Cagle says the organization is hoping to raise about $150,000 towards re-siting and reconstructing the house on its original site, pending approval from the town of Milton. Today in the program, we're listening back to a 2017 conversation with Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin. We'll return to the discussion with a hypothetical question I posed to Coffin about the pivotal role that the Battle of Gettysburg played in the outcome of the Civil War. I asked him, what if Confederate General Robert E. Lee had won this battle?
Well, of course, we don't know where Lee was intending to go after Gettysburg. He was going to capture Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the railhead, to keep reinforcements coming in from the west. But then he might have been headed for Washington or Baltimore, maybe even New York City. But he had a very good chance of winning the war if he had won at Gettysburg and then really invading deeper into the north, because all the Confederates ever had to do in the Civil War was get a tie to convince the Union to give up their efforts. Meantime, the Union had to have total victory to eradicate the Confederate government. So Lee had an easier job in some ways. And if he'd won at Gettysburg, wow, that makes Gettysburg, you know, such an important battle. Jim McPherson, the great historian, friend of mine, thinks Antietam's the most important battle because it brings forth the Emancipation Proclamation. But Gettysburg's right there, too. And after Gettysburg, and you can't say this about Antietam, after Gettysburg, Lee's army was never the same.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Sean in St. Johnsbury. Sean, welcome to the program.
thank you. Thank you for having me. And I would like to thank the author for all the work that he has done in bringing the attention to Vermonters, how important the Civil War is, was, how much pride Vermonters still have. You have from your callers, as well as the great sacrifices. My question I'm prefacing with, I have a understanding and a complete appreciation of freedom of speech. You had just mentioned the victory as a result of Gettysburg. So I'd like to know your thoughts about the display of the Confederate flag here in Vermont, and especially those residences where they are receiving public funding, whether it would be from state or federal.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. The research of the Vermont Civil War history has been an absolute joy, and I've enjoyed most all of it. And Vermonters, yes, I think were the best soldiers in the Union armies. The Confederate flag, hearing a lot about this these days, and the Confederate monuments in the South, some of them are starting to come down. Black communities with the political power to take those monuments down, go ahead and do it. Slavery was the worst aspect of the history of the United States of America. Confederate flags, my belief is that the Confederate flag has no place today except in museums. They shouldn't be in parades, in the back of people's trucks. They shouldn't be anywhere but in museums, because people take offense at them, and particularly black people who have a history of being treated so horribly badly in this country, starting with the great horror of slavery.
Thanks very much for your phone call, Shahan. Let's turn to Paige in South Royalton. Hi, Paige. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My husband was dean of Vermont Law School here for a long time, and we've come back for the summer. But hearing you made me think of my relatives who grew up in Virginia during the Civil War, and their name was spelled P-A-G-E. And my mother went to Oberlin College, and when she was in Oberlin, she went in a house that was an underground railroad run by one of her relatives, I don't know which, and she opened a bookcase on the side of the wall, and it swung open, and she saw very little stairs going up, up, up into the dark, and she was too big to go up. She was a very tall woman. Up the stairs, and the room was over the fireplace, and there was a painting over the fireplace. And when she got down, she looked and she saw that the painting's two eyes were open, or there were holes in the wall so that anyone in there could see if anyone walked into the room.
Well, of course, Oberlin was a hotbed of abolitionist activity. The Underground Railroad down in that area, in the southern part of the North, it was a dangerous enterprise for the escaped slaves and also for those who were spiriting them to freedom. So they really did have to hide the fugitives down there. And clearly you saw an example of the lengths they had to go to. That's a great story.
Paige, thanks very much for your phone call. Let's turn to Neil in St. Albans. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Mr. Coffin, a pleasure to be have you on the radio. I don't want to embellish too much, but I especially love your books when you take us to the fields as they are now and describe them. And some we're losing them left and right. But again, about the Standard Monument, I believe on Route 7 in Georgia, up on the left-hand side, there's a very modest monument, fairly large, but it is to Standard on his birthplace. But unfortunately, there's no area, it's dangerous to pull over there, and it's on private property, I believe. But if you look up to the west, there it is. But on gray days, you can actually pass by and not even notice it.
Yes, it's too bad. It's in someone's front yard now. I've taken bus tours there. They've been very kind and let us stop. and I think you could stop there, drive in, and ask them if you could see it. Yes, it stands above the site of his birthplace, which was just south of that monument site in the little hollow right by the road. I've often thought, standing by that monument, that the site is very much like where he fought at Gettysburg. It's on a ridge. There's a field in front of it, like the fields across which Pickett's charge came. And if you forget about the lake, you've almost got a model of the Gettysburg battlefield there. I hope someday something can be done about a parking lot and better access, or perhaps even moving that monument closer to the actual birthplace, which really isn't very far away.
Neil, thanks for your phone call. I got to ask you this question. In your book, Full Duty, you write about the response that Governor Fairbanks sent to President Lincoln as the Civil War started, and it said that Lincoln sent a telegram to Fairbanks saying, quote, "Washington is in grave danger. What may we expect of Vermont?" And in the book, you write, "Vermont will do its full duty." And you say, with those words, it is believed that Fairbanks responded.
Yes.
Is there some doubt? Do these telegrams exist?
No, the telegram does not exist. Mary Green Nye, who was an archivist with the state, wrote that she saw that telegraph in the collections of the Vermont Historical Society, and it disappeared. She was a very reliable, accurate archivist. I don't think she would have made the thing up. And so perhaps I took a little license and used that bit of information, though I never saw the actual telegram. I have hope someday, as I pile through the VHS stuff, maybe I'll come upon it. Probably won't ever be found, and I've been criticized for using that, but I would do it again and again and again.
Well, you do say here, it is believed.
Oh, yes.
Because there's, no tangible proof, is there?
No, and it sounds like a Vermont reply. One sentence from Erastus Fairbank, who didn't say many words anyway. Vermont will do its full duty, period. And we did.
Let's get a quick call in from George in New Haven. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hi. Listen, I was astounded to hear that the sharpshooters could hit a small target 400 yards away. I didn't realize that anybody was that much of a sharpshooter. And the rifles must have been rifled.
Oh, they were rifled, all right. And, of course, some of them had telescopes on them. You might be interested in knowing that as the Union armies approached Spotsylvania Courthouse in 1864, they were under fire from a Confederate at a distance of 1,500 yards. I think he was in a tree, and the Vermonters came along, were told about this, put sticks on their rifle musket sights to elevate their aim and silence that sharpshooter at 1,500 yards distance. That's quite a display, and it was the talk of the army.
George, thanks very much for your phone call. Just got a little bit of time left, but we've been talking about restoration of Civil War battlefields. How's that effort going?
The effort goes probably as well as it can without there ever having been a massive input of federal dollars. But the Civil War Trust, I was on that board once, has raised an awful lot of money. A lot of battlefield is being saved, but it is being lost every day because the Southerners don't have caring for those sites that we seem to have in the North. But after all, they lost the war. But still, these are great places of American history, and they should be preserved every last acre.
That was Vermont Civil War historian Howard Coffin talking with us back in 2017 about the role of Vermonters in the Civil War, and in particular, the Battle of Gettysburg.